Today is Tuesday, April 16th, 2024. This is Quick Start from CBN News. I'm Dan Andros. Former President Trump's in court, and anti-Israel protesters are blocking bridges. We'll have that top story and more on today's podcast, where we bring you news from a Christian perspective. Don't forget, if you haven't done it yet, go ahead and subscribe and leave a rating. We'd appreciate that. And also email us, quickstartpodcast@cbn.org. Just give us a shout. Say hello. We'd love to hear from you. We appreciate you being here as we're getting through the news of the Cray each and every weekday, bright and early. And joining me today to help us get through it, Trey Gones Phillips, Madison Seals. And we got a lot to get to. And on the focus story today, we're going to be looking at this NPR controversy.
Yeah, this is a really transparent look at the struggle of avoiding bias in news coverage and a bigger question of the potential danger with state-funded media like NPR.
Yeah, that whole saga is really something else. So we'll get to the details on that. Looking forward to it. Also on the main thing, an American missionary is fighting back after he and his family and other Christian leaders are facing serious charges from Nicaraguan officials who accuse them of money laundering and organized crime, what they call trumped up charges. So we'll have that on the main thing. And don't forget, if you haven't already, subscribe to all of our CBN News podcasts, DC Debrief with John Stolness, Newsmakers with Billy Halliwell. You can do so in the description of this podcast. We got the links in there for that. So go ahead and follow those, and we're going to head on over here to the news in 90 seconds. Anti-Israel protesters blocked bridges and highways across the U.S. yesterday, creating a bunch of traffic jams. People trying to reach Chicago's O'Hare International Airport and also in San Francisco on the Golden Gate Bridge. A lot of videos going around online showing people interlocking themselves and using long tubes to prevent cars from going down the road. A lot of them were chanting Free Palestine and Stop Genocide. The stunt forced many travelers trying to make their flights and grab their luggage, and they were running late because these protesters were blocking the way there. And of course, Israel were waiting for them to respond. They promised a response after Iran's shocking attack, their drone attack, where hundreds of drones were sent their way. Thankfully, Israel knocked 99% of those out of the sky. And Donald Trump is in New York in a courtroom as jury selection for his trial is underway. And it'll continue until a panel of 12 New Yorkers and six alternates are selected. Trump's pleaded not guilty to all 34 counts. And Mark Driscoll, who's no stranger to controversy, stepped into the heat once again over the weekend when he rebuked a performance at a conference that he was speaking at and then got kicked off the stage for doing so. Those are just some of today's top headlines. You can check out those stories and more of them like it over at cbnnews.com. Madison, Trey, this Mark Driscoll thing, it's there's some layers here, and it's interesting, and it's caused a lot of conversation in the Christian community online. I know I've seen a lot of it. I'm sure you have as well. We wrote it up on CBN News and faithwire.com. And so essentially there was this performance that on the opening of this conference, it's a Stronger Men's Conference, and in Springfield, Missouri. And the performance, the man rips off his shirt. There's a giant pole going basically from floor to ceiling in this arena or a very large church, mega church, whatever the facility was. A big, big place, a lot of big crowd. And he's going up and down this pole, and it is, it's not a church performance. We'll just say that. So then the clip cuts to Driscoll essentially calling this the Jezebel spirit, denouncing this performance. But then he gets kicked off the stage by the pastor. But the pastor then claims, and this is kind of where the debate is. He says, he quotes Matthew 18 and how we should handle dispute, and says that there was plenty of time between that performance and when he went up, they even interacted, where he could have brought this up and he didn't. And so that's what his problem was with that. So Trey, I'll start with you. What's your reaction there?
Well, you know, I think it's kind of hard to know exactly, you know, what to think when it comes to like the timeline issue, because it's his word against his word, right? I don't know exactly how the timeline shook out. You know, when was this performance, and then when was Driscoll's speech. But I think the whole thing from beginning to end is problematic because, one, why would the church choose? It was at an arena in Springfield, Missouri. It was about 8,000 men. It was at the Great Southern Bank Arena in Springfield. But it was hosted by James River Church, which is a big mega church in Springfield, Missouri. So 100% a church function, a church-sponsored event. Obviously, a lot of preachers coming in, a lot of people, you know, they're intending to cater to Christians and non-Christians. So I think it's fine to have some entertainment because you want to bring in non-Christians. But why would you choose somebody who's not a Christian by any, at least public measure? It doesn't seem like they're a believer, somebody who doesn't have any sort of ministry background. There are plenty of people who do these kind of stunt entertainment type things that you could have brought in who are believers. So I think the choices to begin with were problematic. I think what Driscoll said was fine. There's nothing wrong with what he said, but I do think probably if time did allow, as the James River preacher was saying, it probably would have been appropriate to have that conversation, but also is a good opportunity to point out an error, right? Because it might have been something people didn't realize could have been problematic, and it started conversations for people who were at the conference and people who have just observed that maybe we do need to do some evaluation. Are these the kinds of events we want to be hosting? Because right. I've seen this is not the first church to do something like this.
Right, it's not, and like I guess it should immediately, if you saw that, right, if that was on day one and you were speaking, that should really raise some red flags and have you start asking questions like, wait a minute, what is this church all about that this is something that that got past the gates and they thought this was a good idea to go ahead and lead a massive conference where you're getting outsiders in, like you said, and then this, you want them to have it. I mean, most of these mega churches have phenomenal musicians. It seems like an easy, low-hanging fruit to just, hey, have your musicians play some good concerts right before it and get people in that way. It just seems like a very, very bizarre choice, and it should raise some red flags that you're like, nobody said, hey, wait a minute. But I tend to agree with you. I guess where I land on this at the moment with what I know is Driscoll was correct in his assessment of what he saw, at least from what I could see. Absolutely correct on that. Correct to call it out, but maybe, like you said, Trey, the timing, if he had a lot of time ahead of that to go ahead and address this behind closed doors, he probably should have done that first.
Right. Yeah. With the obscurity of the timeline, I tend to think along the lines of the last point that Trey made about that this was a huge stage and he had the opportunity to kind of call all these people out in the room who sat through that display on the first day and didn't seem to have an issue with it. So maybe he specifically avoided going to the pastor beforehand so he would still have that opportunity. And another thing is, I mean, we can probably all still agree that Mark Driscoll is still a controversial figure to a degree, and he had an opportunity to get up there and preach a message that he had prepared in advance, and instead he chose to say what he did, knowing that he would most likely be kicked off of the stage. So he clearly saw this as an important enough issue to address exactly where he did it on the stage.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And yeah, go ahead, Trey.
Well, the only other thing I was going to add is we should note that Driscoll, like whether you think he should have said what he said to begin with or not, he was respectful of Lindell when Lindell called him out and said, hey, Mark, from the congregation, he said, Mark, you're out of line. You know, you need to step down. And he said, I respect that. I heard that. Thank you for the time. And he left. So there wasn't any sort of argument there. As soon as Driscoll was called out by the organizing pastor, he stepped down and was respectful of that. So there was at least that. I don't know if there's been any conversation behind closed doors since, but you know, he didn't turn it into more of a circus than it needed to be. But then after Driscoll left, Lindell got up and was speaking, explaining what he was thinking as far as how Driscoll should have handled it. And a lot of people in the arena just started chanting, bring him back, meaning Driscoll, let Driscoll back on stage to speak. So it definitely interesting the way it all shook out.
Yeah. Yeah, that is interesting because, you know, that's the other thing. The pastor could have just let it play out and then said, hey, like, and then maybe accepted that rebuke and just said, you know what, maybe we shouldn't have done that. Instead of trying to like cover up the the critique, because if he, I mean, sounded like Driscoll was going to keep on going, like he might have just gone on with his message after he made that observation. Who knows? Who knows how far off the rails it could have been? But again, it's good to talk through these things, I think, not just to like feast on a controversy that happens, but, you know, on a smaller scale in our own neck of the woods, at our own churches, like we've got to run through these scenarios for when you face them so that you know how to handle them. You know, because if you just don't think about it and you put your head in the sand and hope for the best, then you have some sort of conflict. What do you do with it? I mean, I'm sure we've all been in church when somebody stands up and says, I got to say something. And then you're like, uh-oh, like, what do we do with this? And it's a tricky situation to handle because they're feeling led to say something. Perhaps it's not the right time to say it. And so you don't want to, you know, you want to handle that the right way. And so it can be tricky. So from my view, it's good to talk about these things so that we can be thinking about them and hopefully handle them in a Christ-like way when conflict arises in our own neck of the woods, in our own churches, in our own congregation. So, all right, moving on. We're going to head to another controversy. From one controversy to the next, this one in the media, where NPR, there was a lengthy op-ed by an editor who really kind of laid into NPR, and now NPR is responding here. So, Madison, why don't you like give us the groundwork here on what's going on with this story?
Yeah, so this is all about media bias and more largely the need for state-funded media, but it brings up a lot of really important questions. And for those who aren't familiar with National Public Radio, they've been around since the 70s, but their audience is dropping off. And most, about 70% of their audience, is now comprised by self-identified liberals. So this controversy began with an essay by NPR editor Yuri Berliner, who wrote an essay for the Free Press detailing how NPR has zero Republicans among the editing staff in their Washington office. And he also cites examples of bias in favor of Democratic narratives. He notes a few of these things, like after Trump's election in 2016, NPR shut down any skepticism or even curiosity about the truth of Democratic talking points in scandals like Russiagate. And he also says that he was rejected in seeking some sort of balance in their coverage about things like the coronavirus lab leak theory, the Don't Say Gay bill, Hunter Biden's laptop, and the 2016 Russia hoax. So these are all things that he's tried to address with NPR CEO.
And what was the CEO's response when you brought it up?
Well, NPR has already often been criticized for its partisan coverage, and they've received even more criticism for naming Catherine Maurer, I think is how you say her last name, their new CEO in January of this year, so pretty recently. I wasn't too familiar with Catherine before this story, but apparently she's tweeted and since deleted a lot of race-based statements like white silence is complicity and Donald Trump is a racist. And she's also tweeted out that she grew up feeling superior because she's white. So that was all before she was hired at NPR. Now she's responded to Berliner as, quote, profoundly disrespectful, hurtful, and demeaning to his colleagues by calling out the company for its political bias. And in response, she sent out a memo to all of her staff last Friday saying that Berliner attacked not only, quote, the quality of our editorial process and the integrity of our journalists, but also our people on the basis of who we are. And she uses a lot of interesting language in this memo. So I just want to quote a couple of the statements that she made. She says, I joined this organization because public media is essential for an informed public. At its best, our work can help shape and illuminate the very sense of what it means to have a shared public identity as fellow Americans in this sprawling and enduringly complex nation. And then she goes on to address Berliner's article directly, saying that asking a question about whether we're living up to our mission should always be fair game. After all, journalism is nothing if not hard questions, but questioning whether our people are serving our mission with integrity based on little more than recognition of their identity is profoundly disrespectful, hurtful, and demeaning. And then she goes on to conclude that it's deeply simplistic to assert that diversity of America can be reduced to any particular set of beliefs and faulty reasoning to infer that identity is determinative of one's thoughts or political leanings. She says, we fulfill our mission best when we look out and sound like the country we serve. So she really called Berliner out on basically pushing back against the things that NPR has been producing and what their newsroom looks like politically, and basically says that it was a detriment to NPR.
Well, listening to that statement, it really sounds like she dipped in to the progressive alphabet soup and the buzzword soup and just got a bunch of progressive buzzwords and just scooped them on out of there and slapped them onto the page and saw what would come out. I mean, that's what it sounds like. I mean, when you, and really she doesn't seem to address at all the actual, what the criticism that's at play, which was all those stories that you mentioned. Why in the world is NPR that biased and that ignorant on stories and not unwilling to even look at them? I mean, the way NPR handled, I mean, remember what NPR said about the Hunter Biden laptop story, which has now been verified, obviously. They said it was, and I don't have the exact wording in front of me, and I should probably Google it real quick, but it was something along the lines of, this is, we don't waste our viewers' time with stories that are just, you know, irrelevant or meaningless, you know, something like that. I don't have the exact wording, but it was something along those lines. They were very defiant on this. And one would have to imagine that if it was shoe was on the other foot and it was something related to Trump and a Trump laptop, and it really put him, you know, implicated him in potentially shady business deals, influence peddling and all of the rest, they'd absolutely be all for it. I mean, they went all in on Russiagate. They had no problem with that when that one was completely unfounded. And so, yeah, it's really disturbing that this new leader is not just saying, hey, wait a minute, we're doing the best we can. We're going to root out any bias where we can do it. Instead, they just double down and play this identity politic game and try to retreat into the oppression Olympics and say, well, they're just going after our identities. It's concerning.
Right. Yeah, because that was really Berliner's point in the first place. And I think the interesting thing about this story is that we get to hear multiple perspectives, which is important in the news industry. We get to hear from Berliner. We get to hear from his boss, the CEO, and other journalists like Jonathan Turley, who responded to this NPR controversy with a column of his own. And he said the real question here is not the bias of NPR, but the question of why we as taxpayers should be subsidizing any media outlet. And I think he makes some really good points on this article. Like, NPR's take on the news is very similar to MSNBC or CNN, but those networks don't receive tax dollars. So even though their audience, NPR's audience, is shrinking, there's really no motivation to make any changes because the government is supporting their budget. And now they can cater to a smaller audience without having to worry about the pushback from a more Republican or conservative audience. So Jonathan Turley says this controversy should spark conversation about the need and danger of state-funded media. And I think that's why it's important that we as the public have access to firsthand information online, which, even though we have to worry about censorship to a degree, we still have more access to various opinions than ever because we can't rely on one single source to get it right. No political party is completely biased. Unbiased. I mean, no human being is completely unbiased and no network is either. And that's definitely something that we should all strive for by not being afraid to ask questions. But I think that's what Berliner was doing here. He was questioning why NPR doesn't, as his boss put it, look and sound like the country they serve.
Yeah, for sure. I think, Dan, the statement you're looking for earlier is the NPR said that they had no interest in, quote, wasting our time on stories that are not really stories, and we don't want to waste the listeners' and readers' time on stories that are just pure distractions. So,
unbelievable.
If that isn't, like, what's sad to me is that that is an objective statement. I'm saying that in air quotes for people listening, but NPR saw that as an objective statement, and then journalists wonder why people have trouble trusting the mainstream media.
Yeah. And it's not even like, it's not even like Madison's saying, it's not even like MSNBC where you just kind of expect it, like, all right, well, that's, I guess, who they want to cater to. This is supposed to, as Berliner said, reflect the American people. You have to consider that when that's where your funding comes from. Your funding comes from us. You cannot be one-sided on that. And they, a lot of the time, clearly are. So appreciate you bringing that one to the radar today on the podcast, Madison. And with that, we are going to head over to the main thing now. And an American missionary is fighting back after he and his family and 11 Christian leaders, they're facing some serious charges in Nicaragua, where officials accuse them of money laundering and organized crime and a whole host of other things. Britt Hancock is the founder of Mountain Gateway Order, and ADF International attorney Kristen Helkrum joined Billy for today's main thing to discuss why they believe this all boils down to persecution. That's today's main thing.
Well, Britt, I want to start with you today. 11 pastors and ministry leaders have been convicted of money laundering in Nicaragua. This is a very confusing case to people who are sort of coming into it trying to understand what is going on. Can you give us the backstory of what is unfolded here?
Sure. Thank you so much for your question. In 2023, Mountain Gateway helped to organize a series of mass evangelism campaigns, 8 of them, throughout the year. We began in February and had the last one in November. We had 1 million people total come to those 8 meetings. The last one we had almost 250,000 people cram into the national meeting space. It's called the Plaza de Fe in Managua, in the capital city. A month after that meeting, we had thousands of volunteers working, a massive infrastructure. A month after that meeting, the government began to imprison or arrest all of our principal workers. So our main national leader, his wife, the coordinators for all of those meetings, and our main pastors, that they arrested them all by mid-December.
Wow. And, you know, Christina, talk a little bit for us about what they're facing, what these charges are, because of course you hear money laundering and you think, what in the world is going on here? Help us understand from your perspective what these charges are and what actually has happened.
Of course. The religious leaders are being accused of aggravated money laundering, but the government has no proof whatsoever to that extent. Mountain Gateway has tried several times to prove their innocence and to provide evidence to this point to the court, but the government has either seized or prohibited this evidence to reach the court file.
So, Christina, how long are these prison sentences? How large are the fines?
The prison sentences are from between 12 years to 15 years for each one of the religious leaders, and the fines are up to $80 million per person, which is a very high fine for the Nicaraguan judicial system and not common at all.
So Britt, you know, you mentioned these massive evangelistic campaigns that preceded these legal charges. Are you of the opinion that that is why these charges were brought, that this is actually a persecution issue and not actually any sort of legitimate legal issue?
Yeah, without a doubt. Like, we've been working in Nicaragua since 2013. And we've been fine without any problems with the government because we worked in small villages. That's we've been pioneer church planting missionaries for years in Mexico and Nicaragua, and never gotten sideways with the government. We've done humanitarian work, response after natural disasters and things of that nature. Not until we did these massive events has there been any problem. And so it grew to such a scale, like it was a surprise to all of us. The Lord was doing a miracle. He shook the entire nation. We had multitudes of people respond to the call to meet Jesus. And it really seized the social media cycle, the news cycle in multiple countries in Latin America. And we for the year, we became really the dominant social influence in Nicaragua. And they're not okay with that. If anything takes the sort of the emphasis off of them and their narrative, they have a long history of responding very harshly against things like that. And so there's no doubt in my mind that that's the reason.
Well, and that brings us, Britt, to the question of what is the state? Because I think most people probably in America don't know a lot about Nicaragua. What is the state of faith in Nicaragua? And then also the state of religious liberty there?
The Nicaraguan people are beautiful people. They the gospel is in some ways thriving. That doesn't mean that that the environment is positive, but the faith environment is really great. We just had a massive response. There's so much hunger and desperation for God there. It's really an amazing thing. However, when we were working with all these churches, we had 6,000 evangelical churches unify to work on this project with us all year. And we had multiple planning meetings, and I personally met with hundreds and hundreds of evangelical pastors, and every single one of them, if you have a conversation with them about the government, they kind of lower their voice and the reality of surveillance of people being infiltrated in their congregations, watching and listening for them to sort of say the wrong thing. They have to be careful about what they pray, about what they preach. Like the culture there, the environment is not one that's free. They know that if they say the wrong thing, pray the wrong thing, make a stand about the wrong thing, which is in any way being critical of the Sandinista government, then they know that they'll disappear, they'll be imprisoned, or their families will be threatened, or things like that. And those are common stories. And so everybody knows. It's just a common, it's a common culture. There is no freedom of expression, no freedom of speech. And if they say anything contrary to the government, you know, they'll just kind of lower their voices. And, you know, that's the general thought, the general way that people respond.
You know, Christina, as we're sort of listening to this situation there, I'm curious about the situation right now for the pastors and the ministry leaders. We talked about the fines. We talked about the prison time. Where do they currently stand right now? Where are they? What do they face?
They are facing a very dire situation. All of the religious leaders are in maximum security prisons. They do not have contact with their family nor with their attorneys, and they are being denied medical assistance. We are very worried for the state of their health and their life, physical integrity, mental integrity. Human rights violations are happening to them in every sense of the word, from their inability to be able to worship freely to their inability to be able to get help for themselves.
Just a remarkable story there, and we got to continue praying. We've been covering that one, and we'll continue covering it and see what the outcome is there, but clearly praying that they are free to these charges. It sounds certainly like they're trumped up charges. So appreciate you taking a closer look at that one. Billy, that's going to leave us with time for one last thing on the podcast here. We're going to look at Proverbs 3:11-12. My son, do not despise the Lord's discipline or be weary of his reproof. For the Lord reproves him who he loves as a father, the son in whom he delights.
This is a great reminder that God's way is always better than our own or whatever culture says. So his discipline and correction is really for our protection because he loves us.
Yeah, I think it's a good reminder that paints the picture of a parent, because it's easy to think bad things, or punishment is a bad thing or discipline's a bad thing, but it's not, it's good.
Yeah, and that they're doing it like you feel like, they're just harping on me or whatever. But when, especially from the Lord, it's ultimately for our good. So Lord willing, and that creek don't rise. We'll see you all back here tomorrow. God bless. See you then.